Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. And it is Friday, so we'll start with our week in review.
169-10 means we got shots fired at 4:15 a.m. at the Route 291. Sounded like an automatic firearm.
The number of people that have died associated with this event has increased. Right now, we're using the number of 58. The number of injured, we are using the number of 515.
This is a crazed lunatic full of hate.
We have no idea why he did this, and that's what you're going to find out, is I can't imagine. When you guys find out why this happened, let us know.
My first thought waking up this morning is I'll never see my baby girl again. I loved her so much.
So let's talk about Las Vegas and what it means for the country and for us right here in Massachusetts. And joining us to do so this week is Tiziana Deering, professor and co-director of the Center for Social Innovation at Boston College. She's also a member of WBUR's Executive Advisory Board. Tiziana, it's good to have you back.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us is Joe Battenfeld. He's Boston Herald political columnist and host of Battenfeld on Boston Herald Radio. Joe, it is great to have you.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
Well, first of all, let me just get first thoughts from both of you on what's been an extraordinary week in America because of the shooting in Las Vegas. Just Tiziana, your initial reactions.
Actually, it was the listening. We've been through so many emotional arcs, probably several emotional arcs a day over this entire week. And those sounds brought me back to 5:30 a.m. Monday morning when I turned on my TV and saw what was going on and just really wasn't able to process how to feel about it, what to think about it, what it was going to mean. We've been through a lot of political discussion, security discussion, et cetera. But at the end of the day, you just brought us back to the depth of the human tragedy of this week.
58 people dead, hundreds more wounded, many of them still critically. Joe, your thoughts?
I think this country has been shaken by this, shaken like it's never been shaken since probably 9/11, just with the sheer number of casualties and just the randomness of it and the fact that we still don't know why it happened. I think people want an answer. They deserve an answer, but we don't have an answer for why this monster did this. And I think until we may never know an answer, but I think that adds an element of it's almost like people were terrified by this, and they're going to want an answer, but I'm not sure if we're going to have one.
Yeah, and I think what compounds that is, I mean, at least what we know so far, what we can tell so far, is the meticulous preparation and calculation that the shooter did for apparently months, if not years, including looking at other possible locations, amongst them Boston. I mean, so no matter, this happened in Las Vegas, but like it came right back home here potentially very quickly. And Joe, when we found out about that, I mean, what do you think about that? And how you know, our local law enforcement officials and political leaders responded to that?
Well, I mean, this like you said, it brought it home right here, and of course we at the Marathon bombing had to endure that. So one of the targets apparently was Fenway Park, and he researched hotels around Fenway Park, but there are no big hotels around Fenway Park. This is what the reports indicate. And of course, there's a playoff game coming up in a couple of days, and that really brought it home. And I think more than a few people are going to be thinking about that when they go to the Red Sox game today, even though there's no imminent threat, there's no indication of any other person involved in this or that, but it's still going to be on the minds of a lot of people, I think. In the city of Boston, in the initial response, the commissioner said he seemed to be unaware of it. And then they came out hours later and said, oh, wait a minute, he misspoke. We were aware of it. But they didn't inform the public. We had to hear about it through leaks in the media. And I think the public deserves to know what's going on, and the public needs to feel secure.
Yeah.
I understand the need for secrecy and investigation, but the public also needs to know what's going on. They deserve to know.
Did you know you have a thought on that?
Well, you know, it makes me think about my family and I happened to have tickets for the first Sox game after the Boston Marathon bombing. Mm. And the sense that people had in the lines that day, at the game that day, of so many different things. Are we safe? This is an opportunity to come together in community after something horrible that's happened. What's this going to mean for our experiences of these public events in the future? And I do think people all over the country are going to go to every open air, every public event for a while with a cloud hanging over their head about their safety and security. And part of what I think is really important about that is what Joe said about the why. I think we've increasingly are seeing this guy or experiencing him as the monster under the bed, right? It gets darker and darker and more planned with less and less understanding of why. I don't know that we'll ever have a why, and I don't know that people will feel safe if we don't.
Yeah. So, well, then that's a grim reality that we're possibly looking at.
Yeah.
So the work of the investigation has to continue to determine maybe eventually a why. But the how part, we know. We know how he did it. I mean, that's why there's a lot of attention on the fact that at least 12 of the 30-plus rifles that he had with him in the Mandalay Bay had those bump stock modifications that allowed his semi-automatics to basically perform similarly to a fully automatic weapon in terms of the number of rounds that he could fire. And honestly, we're not going to play the sound again because I just don't want to hear it. But everyone knows how rapidly the bullets were being fired from that window in the hotel. But that has led to what is, a raft of legislation on Capitol Hill that we haven't seen in some time around guns and specifically around the bump stock. So let's listen to a little bit of what some national leaders are saying, because there are indeed some GOP-led bills that could ban the sale of bump fire stocks. And here's Florida Republican Congressman Carlos Curbelo.
We want to show the American people that bipartisan compromise is possible on this issue. We can respect the Second Amendment, uphold the Second Amendment, and at the same time keep people safe with sensible restrictions.
This week also, House Speaker Paul Ryan and even White House Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders said that the president would be open to having a conversation about that. The NRA initially seemed to come out and said they, too, might be supportive of legislation. But then NRA Executive Vice President and CEO Wayne LaPierre spoke on Fox News with Sean Hannity last night, and he clarified what the NRA's position on bump stocks is.
Any look at it, it takes a semi-automatic firearm and it makes it perform like a fully automatic firearm. It makes it function like one. And what the NRA has said is we ought to take a look at that, see if it's in compliance with federal law, and it's worthy of additional regulation. That being said, we didn't say ban, we didn't say confiscate.
So there's a lot of room to maneuver here. And Joe, I mean, what do you think? Could they get banned?
I noticed right away that in their statement, they never said the word ban. Yeah. They said we'd be open to regulation of these bump stocks. What that regulation is, is still up in the air. I do think it's possible they could get banned, because there's one reason why it might get banned. And one of the reasons why Republicans are jumping on it is because the bump stocks were approved during the Obama administration in 2010. The ATF under the Obama administration determined that they were devices. They were not actual weapons, that they were devices for weapons, and that they weren't subject to regulation. So Republicans are jumping on that now, and they see an opening basically to revoke another Obama-era regulation in their minds. So I think that's one of the big reasons why Republicans are jumping on it, is because it surfaced first under Obama.
Oh, interesting. If only gun control advocates had known that would be all it takes, they should have legalized a whole bunch of stuff in the Obama administration. But Tiziana, your thought?
Well, the NRA is never, ever, ever going to use the word ban. It's never going to happen on anything ever. What I think is interesting, or an angle about this that I think is interesting, Meghna, is the extent to which the NRA was using a little bit of movement to give cover to Republican legislators who were feeling pressure to do something. You know, this entire set of conversations now, especially around bump fire stocks, is really just a whole bunch of public signaling and positioning to try to create some kind of ground to do something. And this is, if one can step back and look at it this way, you're seeing the incredible push and pull between various constituencies with strong feelings and these public representatives trying to figure out how to navigate that successfully. Yeah. To me, in the end, at least there's something common ground to work on here.
Even, on this one thing.
And yeah. Even on Beacon Hill, there are measures sponsored by Republicans, I noticed today, to ban the bump fire stocks. So,
and Charlie Baker said he'd sign it.
Baker said, yeah. I don't know how the state regulation works with the federal regulation, but I would think the federal regulation supersedes it, but I'm not sure. So a lot of people were unaware of these. Even gun enthusiasts seem to be. They were originally made for the disabled people who couldn't fire repeated rounds because they couldn't use their hands. So I think that's another reason why the NRA seems to be open, at least, to doing something about them, is because I don't think it's not something that's a weapon in their minds, yeah, that's being limited.
Right. So I want to talk to both of you for a moment about how, even though there seems to be a lot of political energy surrounding these bump fire stocks, I don't actually think anything fundamental has changed in the United States about attitudes towards guns. So first of all, let's hear from Massachusetts Senator Ed Markey. We talked to him yesterday, and of course, he's been long for greater gun control. And he talked about, for example, the gun show loophole.
People can go into a gun show and buy, one of these guns without a background check. They're like Kmart's full of killing machines that are just there and able to be purchased. We don't have any discussion of that at all.
So compare that Senator Markey, to what we heard from Representative Steve Scalise. Now, he just got back to work at Congress from having been shot by a shooter at a congressional baseball practice back in June. And he said, in fact, his own, his own challenges and the own incidents gives him a particular perspective on what's happening in Las Vegas, and it's only strengthened his views on the Second Amendment.
We shouldn't first be thinking of promoting our political agenda. And I think we see too much of that, where people say, oh, okay, now you have to have gun control. Well, first of all, look at some of those bills. Those bills wouldn't have done anything to stop this. I mean, the gunmen actually cleared background checks. Yeah. So to promote some kind of gun control, I think, is the wrong way to approach this. And frankly, what I experienced was when there was a shooter, luckily we had Capitol Police there with their own guns.
So for both of you, the last question I have for both of you is, it was interesting. I read an article today that said that after every mass shooting, there is a raft of legislation at the state level. But in many states, it's to loosen gun control laws. So has anything changed at all, Joe?
I think, like I said before, I think the country has been shaken by this shooting, but fundamentally, no, I don't think anything is going to be changed. People are still going to be buying guns, and it's hard for us to envision here in Massachusetts how the rest of the country views guns. It's so different from how we view it here in Massachusetts that it's hard to even imagine that, but most of the people in the rest of the country are going to go on buying guns, feeling like they have a right to buy guns, go to gun shows, which apparently Stephen Paddock bought some of the guns at gun shows as well. But they're still going to go. They're still among the most popular conventions in the country. And so, no, I don't think anything is fundamentally going to change.
I mean, the vast majority of gun owners are law-abiding gun owners, absolutely. But I also wonder, Tiziana, if the bigger issue is that we as a nation just have a very high tolerance for violence.
You know, I don't know. About that, I don't know. I've thought so much about this issue this week and spent a lot of time. I come from gun people. Spent a lot of time talking to people on both sides of this issue. And it seems to me, first, when Joe said at the beginning of today, people are feeling trauma from this like they haven't since 9/11, so something's changed because that was 16 years ago. If it creates any opportunity for conversation, that's important. And it feels to me like this is a time to actually talk about guns, not gun control, not Second Amendment, but guns, and begin to have an educated discussion about who uses guns, how, why, when, where, what are the regional differences, what's the urban gun experience, the rural gun experience, and actually have a conversation about guns that would allow us to begin to create some common understanding.
Yeah.
And maybe, maybe that creates just the tiniest window to begin to navigate through.
I agree with that. I think there was way too much political theater at the beginning. That's the day of the shooting or day after the shooting. There were already bills drafted. Seth Moulton, the congressman, you know, pulled a political stunt and basically and wouldn't participate in a moment of silence, which, you know, was totally unnecessary. It was just designed to draw attention to himself. So I think having a conversation about guns is, makes a lot more sense than any political theater.
Well, Joe Battenfeld, political columnist for the Boston Herald and host of Battenfeld on Boston Herald Radio, great to have you. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
And Tiziana Deering, professor and co-director of the Center for Social Innovation at Boston College, thank you as well.
Thank you.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Let's talk a little bit more about bump stock modifications for semi-automatic weapons and whether or not they're legal here in Massachusetts. Let's turn to State Representative David Linsky. He's a Democrat of Natick, and he's filed a bill to ban such devices in the state. Representative Linsky, welcome back to the show.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you.
I should note that you filed it in the House, and Republican State Senator Bruce Tarr has filed a bill in the Senate as well. So it seems that as if there's a lot of action on Beacon Hill right now about this. What specifically would your legislation change in the state?
So my bill actually has two parts. The first part would be to close a loophole in our laws regarding not only bump stocks, but other devices that increase the rate of fire of an otherwise legal semi-automatic rifle, turning them into virtual automatic weapons or machine guns.
So like any such devices, there's like cranks and things like that.
Right. You see, one thing that I've learned, and I've been involved in gun violence prevention for years and years, is that as soon as the government, in either the federal government or in the states, writes a law, the gun manufacturers alter their manufacturing and design and come up with a way around the law.
Mm-hmm.
That happened with the various assault weapons bans over the past couple of decades.
Yeah.
So you can't just put bump stocks or other named devices in the law. You have to describe the action, and that's what my bill does.
I see. And would it include, I mean, we've been reading, for example, about folks who, you know, could make these modifications on a home 3D printer, for example. So would it include homemade modifications?
That's absolutely right. My legislation, and this is different from the ones that the Republicans file, would ban the ownership, the possession, the sale or the offering of sale or the manufacture of these items as well.
Right. Now, your bill also proposes banning large capacity feeding devices, so high capacity magazines. And we've already got something of regulations around that in Massachusetts. But basically, right, currently, if you owned one before 1994, it's okay. But your bill would seek to change that entirely.
Yeah, it's more than just owned it before 1994. There's a loophole in the law that you could drive a Mack truck through here. See, what happens is that when the legislature years ago passed the ban on large capacity magazines, they grandfathered in any magazine that was manufactured prior to 1994.
Uh-huh.
The problem with that is that magazines, when they're made, don't have either a serial number or any other identification that you can tell when they were manufactured. So it's a law that's on the books, but it is absolutely impossible to enforce.
Okay, so
my bill would close that grandfather loophole.
Okay, so then from a practical enforcement standpoint, I mean, how would it be enforced if that loophole gets closed? Because, you know, the Gun Owners Action League has said that they do have concerns about banning magazines that are already in circulation. They're saying, you know, how do you accomplish that? It turns into confiscation.
Right. So what Connecticut did, they passed a similar ban following the Sandy Hook tragedy. And what they did is that they had a grace period before the law went into effect where you could either register your non-conforming magazines with a law enforcement agency. They set up a registration system, or you had to turn them in, the same that we do in a gun buyback program. We need to get these large capacity magazines out of circulation as best as we possibly can.
Yeah.
The current law, while it's well-intentioned, limiting it to 10 rounds, just because of that loophole, it's virtually unenforced.
Representative Linsky, we just got a couple seconds left, so one last quick question to you. I mean, the governor has said if a bill lands on his desk, he would sign it. So how fast do you think the House and Senate can come together and get something in front of him?
I'm urging the legislative leadership, the House Speaker and the Senate President, to get this going really quickly. I filed my bill on Wednesday afternoon. It immediately picked up about 20 or so co-sponsors in the first couple hours, and there's more than that now. There's a lot of support. We can't wait for Congress to go out and take action on this, because they've proven that they're incapable of doing it.
That's Representative David Linsky, Democrat of Natick. Thanks so much for joining us again, Representative.
Sure. Thank you. Bye.
Well, we've got an update now on a story we brought to you earlier this year. You remember Fearless Girl, the diminutive bronze statue that was placed in a provocative stare down across from Wall Street's raging bronze bull. Now, that statue was put up on the eve of International Women's Day and brought to the world by Boston-based State Street Corporation. The company was laudably calling attention to the gender pay gap and lack of diversity on corporate boards. Well, this update, and perhaps you can guess where it's going, this week it was reported that a federal investigation found that State Street underpaid female and black executives. The Department of Labor report found that pay gaps persisted at State Street even after investigators accounted for, quote, legitimate factors. Now, State Street denies any wrongdoing, but it's agreed to pay a $5 million settlement. A spokesperson says that the investigation focused on executive pay at the Boston headquarters for just the period between 2010 and 2011. State Street disagreed with the findings, but decided to bring the six-year-old matter to a resolution. Now, they also added in a statement, State Street is committed to equal pay practices and evaluates an ongoing basis our internal processes to be sure our compensation, hiring, and promotions programs are non-discriminatory. End quote. So perhaps just one lesson here, if I may. A statue creates powerful awareness, but fair oversight creates change. We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and I'm very excited to say that with me now in the studio is Maine-based best-selling author Tess Gerritsen. She's the author of the thriller series Rizzoli and Isles, and the books follow Jane Rizzoli and Maura Isles, a crime-fighting duo on the streets of Boston. One's a police detective, the other a medical examiner, and a TV show based on the books starring Angie Harmon and Sasha Alexander just recently ended last September after 7 seasons on TNT. And Tess Gerritsen is now out with the latest book in the series. It's called I Know a Secret, and she joins us in the studio. Welcome to Radio Boston.
It's great to be here.
It's great to have you. So first of all, Rizzoli and Isles, based in Boston.
Mm-hmm.
Why Boston?
I live in Maine, and if I were to set a crime series in Maine, it would be really boring. I needed a place that had a decent homicide rate, and we just don't have that in Maine.
You needed the grittiness of the city.
Right, and this was the closest large city to where I am, so I could drive down here to do my research trips.
Oh, interesting. I wonder what Stephen King thinks about that. So Boston's a good place for this. Now, you've got two very different kinds of women as the heart of this series who come together to solve crimes. And so, you know, tell me about writing Rizzoli versus writing Isles.
Well, Jane Rizzoli was introduced first in the book, The Surgeon, and she represents pretty much every female cop I've ever interviewed. You know, they're tough, they're smart, and they have to be better than the men. So that's Jane. And Maura Isles is very different. Maura Isles is me. I modeled her after myself. I think we're both very logical people. We're both medical doctors, and we both want to explain the unexplainable, which means we're frustrated most of the time.
You know, so that combination of law enforcement or detective and medical doctor is a very potent one. There's a lot of great, a lot of great stories, literature. I mean, I'm thinking all the way even back to Holmes and Watson, right?
Mm-hmm.
But what I should have asked is, if Iles is you and you're a trained physician,
mm-hmm.
how did you turn to writing?
Oh, I wanted to be a writer when I was 7 years old,
yeah.
but I'm Asian American. And my father, and as a lot of Asian American parents are, they're very conservative when it comes to their children's occupations. And I was told at age 7 when I said, I want to be a writer, my father said, that is no way to make a living. So he directed me into the sciences, and I love science anyway. So I took a detour as a medical doctor.
But you took a detour?
I took a detour. But I always knew I would be a storyteller. And when I went home on maternity leave for a couple of months, that's when I wrote my first book.
Oh, wow. But obviously your training, your mm-hmm. I love calling it a detour, your detour as a physician is so key. It's because the level of detail that you write in the book, it's obvious that you're bringing a doctor's eye to this.
Well, I think that what's interesting about doctors is that they approach problems in a very particular way. They know how to eliminate the impossible. They're looking in a very logical manner at illness or at death. So that's I think that's the point of view that I bring when I talk about Maura Iles.
Mm-hmm. So, but then about Jane Rizzoli, though, how do you get the authenticity and the detail about her side of things, about law enforcement?
Well, part of it is that I did, when I wrote The Surgeon, I did go to Boston PD, and I was able to talk to a couple homicide unit detectives. And also, Boston PD has a fabulous public affairs officer who's willing to work with writers. So that was how I got my introduction to police work. But I have to say, a lot of it is I make it up. You know, I just imagine, okay, I have this problem. How would I solve it if I were a detective?
Oh, interesting. And have you heard from actual detectives about?
I do hear from homicide detectives around the country, and I do get some interesting calls from them. I think the most weird one was one, I believe it was from Bakersfield. It was a cold case detective, and she said, "We're convinced you know the killer that we've been searching for a couple of decades. Because your killer in one of your books does exactly what our killer did. You must have talked to him, and you must know how he performs, how he does this." And I said, no, I made it all up. But I think it's because I just sort of go through this logical progression. If this is my goal as a killer, what do I do?
Mm.
And unfortunately, it seems that somebody else did something very similar.
You know, this got me thinking that we're talking about your work, which is a fiction series, a thriller fiction series. But of course, we're living just the news this week about what happened in Las Vegas. We all have this real life urge to have the same understanding about what drove the shooter in Las Vegas to do what he did.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, only an investigation will turn up the truth. But I wonder, I mean, do you think that the process of, or like when people engage with thrillers as fiction, that it sort of gives them, I mean, it's fiction, so I don't want to put too much responsibility on it, but does it give folks more insight about, you know, you're writing about some dark world here.
It gives us the satisfaction of answering the unanswerable.
Yeah.
You know, in real life, there are no answers to everything. And in fact, I think that the reason I choose this particular genre is because I was exposed to a homicide case when I was young, a case of somebody I knew and liked very, very much who went to prison for murdering his sister-in-law, torturing her and drowning her in the toilet. And I never saw that in him. I never understood why he did it. And I think that every book I write is a way to explain, to myself anyway, that these people exist and to try to understand why the smiling face sometimes hides something very dark.
That's astonishing. So you knew this person?
Not only did I know this person, I loved this person. He was a father figure to me. And so I think that it's, some psychologists will say that novelists write the one book. They write over and over again the book that they think will answer their childhood question. And that is my childhood question, is how did he do this? Why did he do this? And there are no answers. So, for instance, Stephen Paddock, maybe we'll never know the answer of why he killed all those people.
Did you ever get to ask the question to the person you're talking about?
Oh, he went to prison. He was later released, I believe, and I have avoided any contact with him. Yes.
Yeah. No, that makes a lot of sense. Well, actually, so you answered a question that I was going to ask about sort of what drew you to this particular kind of kind of fiction, and that's. Wow, I have to say, I didn't expect to hear that. That's very powerful. But you've written a movie recently.
Oh, right. Yes, yeah. My son and I made a horror film, independent feature horror film, and I find myself gravitating more and more to film, whether it's television or feature films as a means of storytelling.
Yeah.
I'm very aware now of the large audience out there and of the joys, actually, of telling a story through visual media.
Yeah. So tell me, what did it feel like as an author seeing your books be created into seven series or 7 years worth of series on television?
Yes. Well, first of all, it was a very surprise that it actually happened. You know, whenever you sell the rights to Hollywood, you always think, oh, you know, I'll cash the check and that's the end of it. But to see it become so successful, I think the weirdest thing was to see my characters, who I really had very strong mental images of what they looked like, to show up on television looking nothing like I imagined.
Oh, yeah.
Jane Rosoli in the books is quite ordinary looking. She's every woman. She's the kind of person you can identify with. And Angie Harmon played her on television. So suddenly she's beautiful. So that was the big surprise for me.
Yeah. Well, Tess Gerritsen's new book, it's the latest in the Rosoli and Isles series, is called I Know a Secret. And Tess is going to be at the Flint Memorial Library in North Reading tonight.
Yes.
And tomorrow night she'll be at the Sawyer Free Library in Gloucester.
At 1 p.m.
Tomorrow afternoon at 1 p.m. We'll put information about both those events at our website, radioboston.org. Tess Gerritsen, it's been such a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so very much.
Thank you.
And by the way, folks, before we go, I got a quick update from Game 2 of the AL Division Series. Yes, Sox versus the Astros. Right now, the Sox are trailing the Astros 1-4, and the Astros are leading the series 1-0. We'll have the final score for you a bit later today on All Things Considered, so keep your fingers crossed. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.